You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Do a review tonight of Precious Garland. Venerable Children is still traveling in Asia. And so we'll do a review again like we did last week. And let's first start with our motivation. So we can start with really a sense of appreciation for our fortune that Venerable Children is teaching Geshe Thekchok's commentary on Nagarjuna's precious garland. And really with a sense of gratitude that death has not come upon us yet, and so we still have the opportunity to practice. And we want to practice because we're aware of the dukkha of samsara. Thinking about the dukkha of samsara, then we have this determination that rises to be free from these three kinds of dukkha that we all experience. And then we broaden out that motivation to think not only to free ourselves, but to do what we can to free others as well. And so we can let this motivation really help us to put our full energy into practicing the path without being complacent, without taking our good fortune for granted, and really without being concerned with the mundane affairs of this life, but really keep our focus on the path, which really brings some meaning to our lives. So let's set that for our motivation tonight. So tonight we're starting on quiz 6, and we're in the second section of Precious Garland. We'll see how many questions we can get through tonight. So the first question on the quiz is, what does it mean to refute self and selflessness? And so first, which verses connect with this question?
102.
102, yeah. And 103, yeah. So does anybody have anything about verse 102 that they'd like to share? Children said in the first verse, the 102, she said that self doesn't refer to the person in this verse. It refers to the object of negation. So selfless means it doesn't have the object of negation, which is inherent existence or true existence, or existence from its own side. Those are all synonymous. So when it says all things are selfless, it means all things lack some inherent existence. So whether you're looking at the whole object or you pull out one part of the object or a part of the part, anything you pull out to examine, it all exists dependent on designation. And so the verse says, hence the victors have said that all things are selfless. It has been demonstrated to you that the six constituents are selfless. And then verse 103, in this way, neither self nor non-self are ultimately perceived just as they are. Therefore, the great sage refuted both views of self and non-self. So in this verse, Vinoba Chodron said that the word self here changes according to what we're referring to. So here, when it says neither self or non-self are ultimately perceived just as they are, self here means person, and non-self means the emptiness of the person. So rejecting the views of both self and non-self being inherently existent, the Buddha leads others to abandon these wrong views. So now that the person nor its emptiness truly exists or inherently exists, is what this verse is saying. And then Venerable talked a little bit about referring back to verse 98, which had the qualm about, okay, so the object doesn't inherently exist, but the emptiness of the object inherently exists. And so, and then she said, then someone can come along and say that you're saying all phenomena are selfless contradicts what the Buddha himself stated, because he taught the existence of the self. And he did teach that to those who are similar to the Vaibhashikas in disposition, that there is a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. To others, he said that the self exists but is not expressible as either permanent or impermanent. He also spoke to other people and said there is no permanent, partless, independent self. And so it sounds like he's really contradicting himself, but really he's teaching to different people with the different dispositions. So if somebody isn't ready to hear the final definitive view of what the Buddha taught, then he would teach something that they could take in and work with. So it's kind of similar to how we work with the tenet systems. You know, we start, you know, at the first one and see if we can kind of wrap our brain around that and see how that makes sense. And then as we get familiar with that and that makes some sense, then we're ready to kind of go to the next level. And we keep doing that to deepen our understanding and have our understanding really more subtle, I think. So these were provisional teachings that he gave to people when he sounded like he was contradicting himself. The Buddha's own view, his intention was that there was no self. So again, self refers to the person, and non-self or selflessness refers to emptiness. So neither the person nor its emptiness exists from its own side. Both things and non-things, their emptiness, lack inherent existence. The Buddha rejected both an inherently existent person and the inherent existence of the selflessness of that person. And then the stanza that says, neither self nor non-self are ultimately perceived just as they are. That indicates that when we analyze both the person and its selflessness, we don't find even an atom of inherent existence. So that's one way of explaining that verse. We can also read this verse as saying that a conventionally existent self comes from the previous life, goes on to a subsequent life. This person creates karma, experiences its positive or negative results. So such a self exists, but not a permanent, unitary, and independent self. So again, the Buddha refuted the view that grasps the inherent existence of both a conventionally existent self and its selflessness. And then there's a verse in the commentary on the Middle Way that says, in their minds, yogis perceive that all afflictions and all faults arise from the reifying view of the perishing aggregates. And knowing that the self is the object of that view, they refute the self. Anybody have anything else on that one? Okay, so we can go to question two. So what does it mean that the world is ultimately beyond truth and falsity? So first, what questions are we looking at on this one? I mean, what verses, sorry? 104 and 105, yeah. So 104 is, as for what one sees, hears, and so on, the sage did not call them either true or false. If from one position its opposite arises, both do not exist in fact. And then 105, hence, this world is ultimately beyond truth and falsity. Therefore, the Buddha does not accept that it really exists or does not. So again, this seems kind of contradictory when you first read it. So in the verse 104, when it says, what one sees, hears, and so on, this refers to the six objects of the six consciousness, so the five physical sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. So the Buddha said that these objects are not true or real, meaning they are not truly existent. He also said that they are not false or unreal, meaning that they're meaning totally non-existent. So, you know,
they're not
non-existent. So in saying these objects of the six consciousness are neither true or false, the Buddha is negating the two extremes, because here true means truly existent, false means totally non-existent. So they are obscured truths, conventional truths. And then ultimate truths, emptiness, on the other hand, exists the way it appears, and it is said to be true, but not truly existent. Ultimate truth is empty and appears empty. So sights, sounds, so forth, are not truly existent, but neither are they totally non-existence. So saying that they are not true refutes the extreme of absolutism, or also known as permanence or reification. Saying they are not false eliminates the extreme of nihilism, or also known as annihilation. Then Shantakirti in Clear Words writes, yogis do not fall to the two extremes if they know that conventional truths, which are produced only by ignorance, lack inherent essence, and then know that the emptiness of those has the character of the ultimate. And then in the line, both do not exist in fact, indicates that both the true existence and total non-existence of conventionally existent things do not exist. And then Venerable said, this was quite helpful, I think. She said, emptiness is posited in relation to objects that are empty. The person, aggregates, and so on. Being dependent on these objects that are the basis of emptiness, emptiness is also emptiness of true existence. So both non-true existence or emptiness and true existence do not truly exist. And so if we bring that into our, you know, our experience right now, everything that we're looking at seems like it's solid, set up from its own side, truly existent. And so it's saying this is not true. What we are seeing is not accurate. Any other comments or anything about this one or questions? Okay, we'll go on to three. Is there an end to samsara? Why didn't the Buddha respond to this question? What is the erroneous notion he was concerned with people if he did respond to it. So first of all, what verses are we looking at on this one?
106.
Pardon?
106.
107, 108, I think, yeah. You can see something in each of those. So 106 is, how could the omniscient one say that what he knows to be utterly non-existent is finite or infinite, both or neither? And then 107, there have been innumerable past Buddhas. Likewise, future Buddhas and present Buddhas are innumerable. And the extent of the three times sentient beings is considered to be zillions of times more than those Buddhas. 108, the world's cessation occurring in the three times does not cause its increase. Why then did the omniscient one maintain that its beginning and end are indeterminate? So Venerable talked about how these verses are kind of coming back to the, referring to verse 73 and 74, that talked about how the Buddha didn't answer certain questions, you know, the four extremes. And so people posed questions to the Buddha during his lifetime regarding the self and the world that were based on their assumptions that phenomena existed inherently. And if the Buddha answered the questions, that would have reinforced their misconception that phenomena exist inherently. They would have thought that an inherently existent world didn't have an end, or that an inherently existent person had an end, and such beliefs would harm them. So when people asked those kinds of questions, and he knew that they were coming from that view that they saw things inherently existent, he wouldn't answer. He stayed silent. So an example of a question that they would ask would be, if the world has an end, doesn't have an end, both has an end and doesn't have an end, or neither has an end nor doesn't have an end. So then, but Chodron went on to say that if cyclic existence had a beginning, there must have been a time in the past when it did not exist, and then later it came into existence. And in that case, what brought cyclic existence into being? So the only options are there was either no cause or a discordant cause, such as an external creator. And both of these don't work. So first, a functioning thing such as cyclic existence must be produced by a cause. It can't begin causelessly. And in addition, it could not have a discordant cause, a cause that doesn't have the capacity to produce cyclic existence, such as an external creator. Because if you think about that, then the questions arise, well, what did the creator create? And if the creator is permanent, how could he or she create anything? Because creation entails change. And then what would be the cause of the creator? So it brings all kinds of questions to mind. And so cyclic existence has no beginning. And there was a lot of questions about that when she first taught it. And the best answer that I heard her say, or the reasoning, was to think of the number line, you know. It goes on. There's no beginning to the number line. Yeah. And so cyclic existence has no beginning. And it does have an end. And so her example was, if we hold a seed in our hand and think about its causes and the causes of its causes and so on, we cannot really reach an initial cause that was the beginning. However, if we burn the seed so that it is completely destroyed, it has an end, and its continuity and potency cease. So while ignorance that causes cyclic existence is beginningless, it can be eradicated by the wisdom realizing emptiness. So in that way, the continuity of cyclic existence ceases. Anything else about that one?
That would be a very hard one to debate.
In what way?
For the same reason all the questions came.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
it's just...
I think she said, too, how'd she say that? Something like, Westerners are really big on beginning and end.
Yeah.
Because of our conditioning, I guess.
And so. Far away.
Once upon a time. Yeah. Is that true in Asian culture that beginnings are important? Not so much. So that's peculiar to us. So.
So you know how we have parents.
Mm-hmm.
Those are part of the causes, some of the causes for us. And then those parents have parents.
Mm-hmm.
Those parents have parents, etc., etc. By the same line of reasoning, you would say that there has been humans since beginningless time because parents always need to have parents. However, evolution says that at some point they were not humans, they were, you know, apes.
Mm-hmm.
And they slowly transformed into humans.
Mm-hmm.
So could you also say that sentient beings have been, you know, they were not always sentient beings, they were something and then slowly they became into more complex sentient beings? Because it seems that that could also be, you know, that wouldn't contradict anything, you know. Everything has to have its cause, but it wouldn't be colloquially called a sentient being.
Sentient being. I don't know about that.
They would still have to be sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
Sentient beings are not human. Right? The consciousness is the consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the consciousness that's the important piece with that. And then too, oftentimes, you know, we're just thinking about this earth here, and Venerable always reminds about there are many universes we don't know anything about that have, you know, all kinds of things going on there.
Including other humans.
Including, other beings.
That's all.
This is it, This is all there is, And then I think she finally ended up with saying, I don't remember how she said that. Something about, you could spend all your time trying to figure out the answer to this kind of question, but it's not going to get you to enlightenment. So maybe drop it and practice something that will give you some result, maybe.
There's a story where the Buddha responds somewhat that way. Where the Buddha responds to a question about God, about cosmology.
Mm-hmm. Cosmology.
Cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
He tells a story of someone who gets shot with a poisoned arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And the man, his friend, wants to pull the arrow out. He's like, no, I need to know first who shot the arrow, whose kid's been on, what the bow was made of. And the friend is like, no, we need to pull the arrow out now and not worry about that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's not important.
Yeah.
Pulling the arrow out is important.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good, I forgot about that.
That's a good story,
yeah. And so that whole thing about, you know, what information is a question going to give you? How is it going to be helpful? How is it going to impact your practice particularly? So that's helpful. Yeah. Okay. So,
go ahead. Also, we're talking about the Buddha saw that his questioner was seeing things as inherently existent.
Mm-hmm.
But he must have also been seeing that that person was not right to learn about the emptiness of inherent existence.
Yeah.
As, you know, teachers are taught not to teach emptiness to people who are not ready, it will be detrimental to them.
Yeah. And just to think about the kindness of somebody that is going to protect our mind from something that's going to, you know, pull us away from the path or, you know, get us all confused. That's quite lovely, to have that kind of care by a teacher or by the Buddha. So question 4, have some beings always been Buddhas? Was there a first Buddha? No and no.
Yes.
Yes and yes?
The first Buddha is one.
Ah, yeah. In the historical sense. Yeah. You can
first
talk
Buddha
about
was what?
In this particular world system, you know, that we have 1,000 Buddhas will appear and in this fortunate eon. And 3 have appeared already, and the current one is Shakyamuni.
There's also the idea that Samantabhadra never defiled. But Venerable said something about that maybe being more of a myth.
Yeah. So now, no matter how far back we go in time, Buddhas have been present, but that doesn't mean that some beings have always been Buddhas. So everyone who is now a Buddha must have become a Buddha gradually through amassing the collections of wisdom and merit. Every Buddha was formerly a sentient being, so there is no one who has always been a Buddha. That's actually comforting, isn't it? So the virtue sentient beings create is related to the Buddha's awakening activity and is due to the blessing and inspiration of the Buddhas. Since virtue has existed in the mind streams of sentient beings since beginningless time, and its causes is the Buddha's awakening activity, there must be countless Buddhas stretching back in beginningless time. To say that there was a first Buddha, we would have to posit another Buddha prior to him, who was his teacher and guided him on the path so that he could attain full awakening. And that Buddha would have received teachings from previous Buddhas and so on. And so it's helpful to kind of think about the Buddha's awakening activity. That, you know, there is blessings and inspiration from the Buddha. If we can open our hearts and minds, we can be influenced. Yeah. And many of the great masters have had that. Yeah?
What was the answer to the second question? Was there a first Buddha?
No. Because you'd have to have a Buddha that taught that Buddha and back and back and back. So, again, a beginningless time idea again here.
But no one has always been a Buddha? That there's always been a Buddha?
Yeah. Which is so easy to do because of our conditioning.
Yeah.
Yep.
I wish I could just shut up and not say anything, but...
No, please. But what?
Okay, so we were talking about this in the car on our way here, and there's this one question that you might say about the poison arrow if I ask this question, but if I don't ask it, I'm going to explode. Are there infinite sentient beings?
Infinite? No.
No, okay, so there must have been a first Buddha then.
Why?
Because, say that there's 3 sentient beings ever, and there will ever be. Beginningless time doesn't imply that there was always, that you can't choose the first Buddha. Because one of those 3 had to get enlightened first.
Yes. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It's like only infinite beings imply that no matter what Buddha you choose, there's always going to be a previous one. If there's a finite number of sentient beings, there's got to be a first Buddha. You guys said,
Is there a finite number of sentient beings?
Yeah, they're not necessarily beings coming into existence.
They're limitless. Yes.
Calculable,
yeah,
but
not infinite. Yeah. Okay.
Not infinite. Mm-hmm. So there's more than three, in other words. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a finite number of sentient beings, but their mind streams have existed beginninglessly.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah, yeah. There you go.
There's not a beginning to those finite, any of those finite sentient beings. Mm-hmm. That's how we get around that dilemma.
Mm-hmm. That's right, but that, you can still choose the first one, though.
Choose one how?
Okay, so choose any Buddha, right? And you say, there's a Buddha before that one. So then you choose that one, right? And then you say, there's a Buddha before that one. So you do this as many times as you want, and eventually you're going to find the first Buddha, because you can only do this as many sentient beings there are. Say there's a million sentient beings, right? You do this a million times, you're going to find the first one.
That's beginningless lives.
Yeah, begin.
So if you have two sentient beings have beginningless.
Yeah, but one of those had to be enlightened first. It doesn't matter how long they've lived. All that matters is how many there are, and one of those has to be the first one. The fact that they have lived since being at this time doesn't imply anything. It's just a game of numbers.
How do you mathematically prove that there is a first Buddha?
I just proved it to you right now. Just do this enough times and you're gonna find the first one. Because there's only so many sentient beings to choose from. There's not infinite amount of non-puffs and things.
But it's the beginning of life, so that means this number, the lives they have is, you can't count.
You can't count.
No, I mean the continuity, not like one specifically, the continuity, that's what. Anyway. This might get into the poison arrow thing, but like, one thing is like, if you're talking about emptiness, you can't ask me not to ask questions. That's just,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's
no one is saying don't ask questions.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, like,
yeah, it's nice. We just don't have the answer, maybe. Yeah. So I'll just read again what Venerable said. She said, to say there was a first Buddha, we would have to posit another Buddha prior to him who was his teacher and guided him on the path so he could attain full awakening, and that Buddha would have received teachings from a previous Buddha and so on. So, beginninglessly. So I have no other answer than that. Stumped again, yeah.
That's not one of the questions that the Buddha was asked, is it? Whether there was a first Buddha. There's like 14 questions or something he didn't answer.
Yeah, I don't remember all of those.
I don't either, but yeah. I don't think that's one of them.
But again, maybe this is one of those questions that whether we had the answer or not, it probably wouldn't impact our progress on the path, you know.
Unless if you didn't get that answer, you would not continue on the path.
Yeah, in that way. That's true. Yeah, if it was a deal breaker for you, I guess.
Deal breaker for you, the chances are it doesn't have any significant cause for awakening.
This discussion relate to verse 106. How could the omniscient one say that what he knows to be utterly non-existent is finite or infinite, both or neither? Existent is finite or infinite, both or neither.
So in other words, our sentient beings neither finite.
I don't know.
So now, sentient beings are not infinite.
Mm-mm.
So are they finite?
They're innumerable.
They're innumerable, yeah.
Shambha Tetra was saying,
uh-huh.
There's no beginning to sentient beings. No new sentient beings arising that did not exist before, in the sense that each sentient being that exists now comes from its own previous continuum. There are also beginningless Buddhas in the sense of there being no time that there were no Buddhas. But that does not mean that some beings have always been Buddhas. Nayan, it goes on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a good question for Venerable Children when she comes back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no beginning to sentient beings, no new sentient beings arriving that did not exist before, in the sense that each sentient being that exists now comes from its own previous continuum. There are also beginningless Buddhas in the sense of there being no time that there were no Buddhas.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, or should we move on? So, yeah, go ahead. Yes.
My note says, in general, there is no time when all sentient beings. There is a time when all sentient
Here's
beings.
Here's the mic, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
So my notes say, in general, there is a time when all sentient beings will attain awakening. So that in general sometimes covers up. I mean, that statement is true, but in general, there might be some things to debate about.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to question 5. Explain the analogy of the magical illusion of horses and elephants. What are the 3 perspectives, and how do the people having each one react to what they see and know? So what verses are we looking at?
110 and 111.
Yep. Anybody want to tackle, or should I go? Okay. So in ancient India, magicians could make sticks and stones appear as real horses and elephants through the use of special substances and mantras. Some of the animals may even look like they are being born or dying, looking truly existent. The audience, the magician, and the latecomers to the show relate to the magical display in different ways. So the audience is under the influence of the spell of the mantra and the special substance. So they see real horses and elephants with their eyes, and they mentally believe there are actual horses and elephants there. Similarly, phenomena appear truly existent to us ordinary sentient beings. Under the influence of ignorance, we apprehend and conceive of truly existent people being born and dying, although there are no truly existent people or things at all. Never doubting the accuracy of these appearances, we do not see things as illusory, but believe they exist the way they appear. The magician is affected by the spell and magical substance, so real horses and elephants appear to him. However, unlike the audience, he knows they are illusions and does not grasp them as real. In other words, his visual consciousness sees horses and elephants, but his mental consciousness knows that they are only an appearance and doesn't think that they are real. So similarly, things appear truly existent to ordinary beings who have realized emptiness conceptually into aryas in post-meditation time. However, they are not deceived by the false appearances because they have realized that things do not truly exist in the way they appear to us. They know they are empty and they do not grasp them as truly existent. And then the third group, the latecomers to the show, they're not affected by the special substance and mantra. So horses and elephants neither appear to them, nor do they apprehend horses and elephants. Similarly to Arya's meditative equipoise and emptiness, truly existent phenomena neither appear nor are they apprehended. And so spectators are terrified when a magical elephant charges at them. Similarly, when things happen in our environment because we think they are truly existent, we very easily fall prey to attachment, to things that appear beautiful, and we feel fear and anger to appearances that are threatening. Because of our ignorance, we are so reactive, we impute all kinds of meaning to these appearances, and they really can make our minds so very miserable. And it all comes from our own mind. And even when we get new information, we can't let go of the past imputation often. We see it as truly existent, and we have such a hard time to let go. And so we hold on to grudges due to this grasping at true existence. And so really, it doesn't matter if a person is afflicted or not, you know, if we're having an interaction and somebody is afflicted or whatever. What matters is our reaction to it. So if we totally believe the appearances instead of remembering things exist differently than they appear, we would not have a reaction of attachment or anger. It has no more meaning than what we impute on it.
Ever.
We were at a museum today when we had the bodies human, where they were the corpses that had done some work on and taken all the fluids out. But we're all walking around these bodies that had the skin taken off of them. They're basically down to muscles and sinews. And to realize that how powerful the mind is by just simply reapplying the fat, the skin, back onto those bodies and putting a mental consciousness in them changes our entire relationship to these things. I was fascinated, but I was totally indifferent. There wasn't any attraction, mm-hmm. there wasn't mm-hmm. any aversion, but you give me somebody that I think is attractive, who's got the skin on and is walking mm-hmm. and talking, mm-hmm. totally different. But then Steve and I were standing there, he said, this was somebody's husband. This was somebody's brother. This was somebody's good friend. And then this was one of your mothers in previous life. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it, you realize the imputation, because we've taken off enough, that the imputation was really pulled off of it. Mm-hmm. To really see the power of our minds mm-hmm. when we look at each other. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's true, actually, even when you see a body that somebody has died. It is so starkly different than a living, you know, they're not there anymore. It's so clear, you know. So it's like just this, you know, this heap of, they're gone, you know. So it kind of has that same, but of course, you know, often you have a connection or whatever, you know, in some way. But it's still that same thing.
But the power of the mind, that's really yeah. what came to me very clearly. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Powerful.
Yep. 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 You had something, Venema Sepal?
I just remember watching a cremation one time in Dharamsala, mm-hmm. and even though intellectually I knew the person had died, when they put the body on the fire, there was a sense of, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. they're going to harm the person, mm-hmm. even though the person died. Yeah.
Intensive purposes, yeah.
Was gone.
Gone, yeah. 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 The magician sees the elephant or horse is charging, but knows it's not real, and thus is not afraid, just watches. This is like those who have realized emptiness. They see truly existent things, beautiful things, horrific things, but they don't see them as real, so they don't have that emotional reaction to them. Yeah, but when you try to, when I've tried to kind of practice that a little bit, this thing comes up in the mind like, it's going to be so flat or boring or disconnected, and that is so upside down, that that is so turned around. That's really to see the ignorance so clearly, because if we didn't react, all that space that we're calling boredom would be filled with love and compassion. You know?
Yeah.
All of it would be filled with that.
I think that's often people's reaction when they hear about attachment. People, when they hear about attachment, trying to get free of attachment, are often like, how can I help relate to people if I don't have attachment?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they don't see anywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe us.
Yeah.
Definitely an obstacle.
Yeah.
We definitely have a harder time seeing the negativities of our attachment than of our anger sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Venerable talked about, she brought up the phrase when teaching these verses, bickly bickly boo. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
She said if someone says that to you and someone translates it to you as, they just said, you're an effective jerk, you react one way, but if somebody else were to translate, oh, they said you're a wonderful, kind person, you react
a different way. Yeah.
It's just impugning on the sound.
Yeah.
Neither one of those translators might know what it means.
Yeah.
I've been thinking that practicing in virtual reality might be
then hold it like this.
In virtual reality might be very helpful to my own learning. Because in one that I saw recently, a person has the experience of climbing up a wall, like you would if you were practicing. Mm-hmm. But of course, you're sitting in a chair or you're standing.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you work with it, you are giving your mind the opportunity to separate from the idea that it's real or not real.
Mm-hmm.
But the fear and the emotions are involved, so I think it could be powerful to dampen down yourself and learn to tolerate that it can be safe and be very different.
Yeah, I think that we can do that under meditation with, you know, a good visualization and kind of rehearse how to do something again, especially if the way that we did it was not skillful, and learn from that, you know. I mean, at least that's how I try to use that one. But we're so tied to our senses that it's hard to think about doing it without sense input. And then the last group, the latecomers, see only sticks and stones and wonder what all the fuss is about. So similarly, in meditative equipoise, the aryas don't see all these false appearances and no emotional reacting.
Well, one of them is, I think, is the aryas in
meditative
equipoise, which is the spectators, and the magician is in a subsequent
the
team.
Yeah.
The latecomers.
Yeah.
Latecomers are post, is it the other way around then? Yeah.
So similarly, in meditative equipoise, the aryas don't see all these false appearances. So in meditative equipoise, And then the other one was, the magicians.
Magicians are always in post-meditative.
In post-meditation time,
Or new beings with them.
Yes.
Inferential.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the duped audiences are us.
Yeah. Every moment. Totally
we're enjoying
duped.
Enjoying it so much.
Yeah. Until we're not. Until we're not. Yeah. It's really good until it's really bad. Yeah.
We like those circuses.
Yeah. Christina.
I keep going back to the analogy to the Matrix, the movie.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if everyone's seen that, but to me, it, like, the Matrix would be conventional reality, and ultimate truth would be when you're unplugged from the Matrix, and conventional reality has its own set of rules that are consistent and logical, but it's a matter of just realizing program, it's not really reality, and you have to find your way out of it. Mm-hmm. And I just keep coming back to this comparison.
Yeah, so that's one way that you can really get a handle on what realizing emptiness would, what that reality would be like. Yeah, whatever works. Okay. 6. Do illusory horses and elephants ultimately exist?
No.
Do they conventionally exist?
As illusory horses and elephants.
Do horses and elephants ultimately exist? Do they conventionally exist?
Yes. Oops.
What verse are we looking at here?
112.
An illusory elephant does not come from anywhere, nor go anywhere. Since it is merely a manifestation of mental confusion, it does not ultimately exist. And 113, so too the world, like a magical illusion, does not come from anywhere nor go anywhere. Since it is merely a manifestation of mental confusion, it does not ultimately exist. And when they say come from anywhere, go anywhere, they mean inherently. You know, that's not in there. Oftentimes, so many of these verses don't have the inherently on there, but that's what they're meaning. Illusory horses and elephants don't come from anywhere. It's just an appearance. And so it's like, you know, when we watch a movie on TV and a couple falls in love, you know, and da-da-da. Are there really people falling in love? No.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Big problems on set.
Oh, please. And then when they both die in a car accident, are they really dying? No. It's just pixels on the screen, you know?
Do we really cry?
Yes. Yeah. But again, this is that same thing, you know, if you keep remembering that it's pixels on the screen, then you stop having emotions regarding the movie. And then, you know, you feel like, you know, what am I doing this for? Or, you know, nothing really happens, no enjoyment. So we go from one extreme to the other. You know, we're so addicted to our emotions. Our emotions make us alive in a truly existent way.
Yes.
Our emotions make us alive in a truly existent way. There is a real me who feels it. So that's a dilemma.
Oh, this thing about the pixels on the screen, and maybe Venerable Losam's thing about attachment, just brought to mind this sort of this principle of theater where the audience is engaging in a willing suspension of disbelief. The term, like willingly letting go of its capacity to not believe and then allow themselves to be pulled into the how much in the course of a day, I mean, maybe if you have no awareness of this at all, or no awareness of all that things don't exist in the way that they appear, that's one thing. But if you start to have some sense that maybe things don't exist in the way that they appear, but we don't have much conviction, like none, we just think it's a nice idea, that willing suspension of disbelief, like allowing yourself still to go, I don't know, I've had that feeling. It's like, I know this isn't true. Mm. I know this isn't real. I can even say that this is an afflictive emotion. Do I choose to go there or do I not choose to go there? And sometimes you can do your own willing suspension of disbelief and follow the habit.
Yep.
And you're gone.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's a, it's, I don't know, it's a, to me, it's an interesting, a useful phrase to have in my mind. Mm-hmm. Participating and as willing suspension. Mm-hmm.
Gosh, it's so automatic.
Yeah.
And when we do anything like watch movies or TV, we are reinforcing and strengthening the ability to get lost in something that is, you know, totally
fabricated.
Good point.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's very curious. So I found something that Alex Berzin wrote that I thought was kind of interesting, that I kind of wanted to close with. I'm just going to read it, and it kind of ties things together a little bit. Upekka is shredding the carpet as we speak. So the Buddhist tenet systems present graded levels of understanding, not only of how things exist like an illusion, but also of how cognition works and many other important aspects of life. When studying these systems, it is important to avoid thinking that they are merely dry theories. They provide essential material for meditation to gain ever deeper understandings. The purpose for gaining these understandings is not for acquiring intellectual knowledge. It is for applying them to everyday life in order to overcome our individual problems and enable us to help others most effectively by bringing us enlightenment. With the Vibhashika understanding, we have deconstructed the illusion-like appearance of sense objects and consciousness being solid and permanent. With the Sautrantika understanding, we have cleared out other projections from them as well. Further, with the Chittamantra understanding, we have cleared out the misconception that the appearances of sense objects are established from their own sides. They are established by the karmic potentials of the minds that cognize them. With the Svatrantika understanding, we have cleared out the further misconception that the existence of any validly knowable phenomena is established exclusively from its own side. The existence of any validly knowable phenomena is established through a combination of something findable on its own side and mental labeling. According to the Prasangika, however, although all phenomena appear to have findable characteristic features on their own sides that establish their existence as this or that in conjunction with them being labeled this or that, this is like an illusion. If there were such findable features, they could lead to attachment and grasping to them. We could still place the blame for our problems on external objects or on a me. There must be something inherently wrong in me, making me no good. The true cause of our problems, however, is the minds making deceptive appearances of impossible modes of existence and the unawareness and grasping that come from that. Because the deceptive appearances of impossible modes of existence are produced by the mind needs to stop projecting them. If the existence of objects as this or that were established by something from the side of the objects, even in conjunction with mental labeling, This could shift the focus of attention away from the mind's confusion as the source of our problems. It could shift it to analyzing only externally to find the inherent characteristic features of objects that make the objects what they are, so that we can mentally label them correctly. Therefore, we need to understand existence established by mental labeling alone. The existence of any phenomena, according to Prasangika, is established merely by the fact that it can be validly imputed, or labeled, on a basis for imputation. What the label refers to cannot be found on the side of the basis for imputation. Not even the defining characteristic features of what the label refers to can be found there. What establishes that the labeling of the phenomena is a valid labeling, consequently, what establishes that the phenomena that the label refers to is an existent phenomena that is validly knowable, are merely criteria from the side of the mind. And so those three are: the label needs to be well-known, a well-known convention. The label needs not to be contradicted by a mind that validly cognizes the superficial truth of the phenomena. The label needs not to be contradicted by a mind that validly cognizes the deepest truth of the phenomena. When we investigate how things exist, we discover that they are simply what can be labeled by names or concepts. All phenomena lack any existence other than when established simply in relation to names. Although the manner in which all phenomena exist is like this, the manner in which our mind gives rise to an appearance of them is just the opposite. They do not appear to be merely something the existence and identity of which are established by the fact that they can be labeled to be what they are, simply by conceptual thought or mental labeling. They appear as if they were establishing their true existence by themselves, by their own power, from their own side. Because our mind, due to its beginningless habit of being unaware of the actual manner in which everything exists, makes things appear in this manner, and due to its continuing lack of awareness, apprehends them to exist as such, our mind implies something about these appearances. It implies actual objects existing from their own side that correspond to what it makes appear. Because of this implication, impulses of karma arise to deal with life on the basis of being deceived by our mind's discordant appearance-making. Enacting these impulses, we cause ourselves to wander through uncontrollably reoccurring rebirths, experiencing the suffering that our unawareness creates. I thought that was really clear, what he said.
What's that from?
Oh, it's from Alex Berzin.
Archives.
Pardon?
Archives?
Yeah. I can send around that link. I don't have it on here, but I have it on my other computer. But it helps to, for me, it helps to go over and over this again and again, because it's so easy to forget, you know, what we're doing here. Yeah.
How's Prasangika different from Chittamatra?
Well, and that's a big question, but briefly, I guess, Chittamatra is saying that really everything comes from the mind. Yeah, but I think with Prasangika, if you think in terms of dependent arising, that it's the combination of all of these things coming together. Though, I don't know, that's how I would answer that.
We don't posit an external object, right?
So yeah, Chittamantra
doesn't. Chittamantra doesn't, so it's the, latency on the mind is the same substantial cause as the, and so the object and the cognizer and the same substantial cause.
Maybe sound. You should get the mic, because that's important, if you don't mind.
There's the reification of the mind.
The reification of the mind.
They assert truth.
Yeah.
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 Okay, so kind of repeat what's
there. Are many, many differences between those two schools.
Yeah, they're big.
Yeah.
But a big one, pertinent to your question, is that the Chittimatras don't posit no external objects. Now, what that means, we've also been trying to debate a little bit, figure out, but that there are no external objects, and that the mind apprehending the object and the object itself arise simultaneously from the same imprint in the mind. That's a substantial cause of both of these, which is quite different from the Prasangika view of how things come together and how the object is a part of creating consciousness that apprehends it in the next moment. That's right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's so anyway, it's one of the big differences. But it's if you talk about, they both say it comes from the mind, but in really different ways.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. Let's dedicate.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous action spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Peerless Supreme Spiritual Leader, Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Motherly Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, a Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With a clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Tipton, the Able One's teachings, you bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of children, of the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in a glory of eternal bliss. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West,